Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Our matey, Father Daniel, nice to be here with you.
I knew you looking at you with an eye patch on.
What the heck happened?
Yeah. Okay, well, I had a detached retina. So about 2 weeks ago, I started experiencing these symptoms, and then sure enough, detached retina, had surgery last Thursday, and so I've been walking around blind in one eye for about a week. Little by little, it's coming back, though, so it's a temporary blindness, thanks be to God. But gosh, Chris, it's given me a whole new appreciation for the gospel passages where Jesus works a miracle to heal blind people.
Yeah.
Gosh, there's so much we rely on with our vision that we take for granted.
Right. Well, let's all pray that your health and your eye continues to progress back
well,
to
100%. Well, a lot of people have been praying for me. I deeply appreciate that. So
yeah.
Good. So what topics do you have for us today?
The first one we're going to talk about is socialism, and this college professor of business at Lebanon Valley College wrote an op-ed for the Wall
Street
Journal.
Where's Lebanon Valley College?
I'm guessing in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So the op-ed was written about how colleges produce, the title of it was How Colleges Produce Socialists.
Sure.
So she talks about how beginning in the 1990s, colleges got into this aggressive arms race on trying to recruit students with these rec centers that are all mm-hmm. decked out with climbing walls and lazy rivers and dorms that have morphed into apartment lofts mm-hmm. that have like lounges and, you know, these crazy dining halls. Very cushy.
Mm-hmm.
Today's universities, she argues, have basically become these all-inclusive resorts that are paid for indirectly through tuition and donations so that students never see a price at the point of use.
Interesting.
She argues that 4 years inside this bundled, cost-invisible system trains students to see collective, centrally administrated economies as normal. And when they graduate into a world of itemized bills, they start calling everything an affordability crisis when, in fact, it's just a culture shock from the unbundling of prices that they are now seeing.
That's an interesting take.
It is, and I think it nails it. So her closing point is that universities claim to prepare students for a market economy while running one of the least market-like environments possible. So it's no small wonder that young college-educated students or graduates are leaning into socialism. I think she nails it. I mean, I've always thought this, and I remember myself, I graduated from college in 1990, and when I was in at University of Texas, we worked out in this rusty, dank gym below the old gymnasium.
Probably
that
has some
the
black
team,
mold in it.
Yeah, it was nasty, but they were building this new rec center
right.
in 1990. I was like, gosh, if I could just been here, you know, for that, because it was cool, and I'm sure even that thing is now way outdated.
Obsolete, yeah.
Yeah, but it is. It's like you are living this country club lifestyle for 4 years, and then you come into reality where you're taking a big pay cut, mm-hmm. really, in the form of how you're living,
yep.
right? And it does. It makes sense that this, you know, this unbundling of prices that you all of a sudden see really does foment this aggressive reaction to it, which mm-hmm. is, you know, let's go back to the way it was.
Yeah, that was so comfortable. That was
right.
easy. Yeah, and I think part of the problem is parents who have maybe coddled their children a little bit too much and given them a free ride through college. I oftentimes talk with parents about this because in my own family growing up, my parents didn't have the wherewithal to pay for any of our education in college. I went to seminary, so my expenses were covered, but all of my siblings paid their own way through college.
Yeah.
And because they did so, they were on work-study programs, they were getting loans, they were working jobs during college. They took it very seriously because they knew how much it cost and they knew what they were working towards.
Yeah.
And each one of them put themselves through college.
Yeah.
And so a lot of parents who are paying the bill, what does that foster? Fosters a mentality like, hey, I'm living on daddy's dime.
Yeah.
Let's live it up.
Right.
And so you have the party schools and the problems that all that entails and the change of majors. So I think parents have a lot to answer for in this.
Right. Well,
equation.
The universities aren't part of the equation because, you know, when I went to school, you know what my tuition was each semester?
$2,000?
No, no. $200.
Are you serious?
My oldest brother went to school
in the 1940s?
Yeah, no. So Texas was a bit unique. They have a permanent university fund, which two-thirds of the oil royalties from this field in the Permian Basin go to the University of Texas, and one-third goes to Texas A&M. Mm-hmm. So it goes to help defray
tuition costs. Yeah.
But my oldest brother went to Texas, and his tuition was $12 a semester.
Wow.
And then you had the football tickets, was an extra $250. So it was like on the fall, you paid $250 plus the $200 tuition. So it wasn't, but now, I sent two of my kids from Georgia to University of Texas out of state, and it wasn't $200 a semester.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So, and it's all those things that these giant tuition payments that we're making are for lazy rivers mm-hmm. in the rec center. Mm. I mean, that's where it's going. That plus, the university has 15 different provosts of, for whatever, trash can.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that aspect, because I think it's very interesting take from this author, like identifying this aspect that's contributing to socialism. But another key part of it is the tenured professors who are socialists,
right?
Who couldn't get a job in the real world in a market economy,
right.
And have found a captive audience that they can prey upon and foist their ideas upon
absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely.
This has always been another huge problem.
Right, but that's always been in existence. At least that was what I experienced in college.
Yeah, from the 1930s on.
Yeah, I experienced the same thing. But what's changed is this living experience now where, this unbundled cost versus the bundled, and the reality check when you graduate really is.
Well, and it ill prepares them for the real world because they've been coddled and it's so easy and they live comfortably, and then they get out into the work world. I was just talking yesterday with a young man who's just in his first job, and it's tough. His boss is pressing him and said, hey, you're going to get fired if you don't increase your productivity. And I can understand where a young person faced with the realities and pressures of a market economy would say, gosh, this is really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I want to go back to what's a little more comfortable.
Right.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
There's a new K-12 school opening in the Bronx, New York, which, by the way, is America's poorest congressional district.
Is it now?
It's called the Success Academy, and it costs $245 million to build and will have 2,400 students based on the charter school model. Mm-hmm. The building was designed with lockers with no locks, which I find fascinating. The principal says you put a lock on a locker and kids bring things they're not supposed to at school. When there's no lock, there's no contraband. So
interesting
yes.
thought.
So they have a playground with deliberately non-safe equipment. I'm not sure what that means, but like as a kid, you don't see a merry-go-round on a playground anymore.
Yeah, I think it ties back to Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation. He talks about the importance of free play and getting out there where it can be dangerous. You can get hurt, you learn things from that.
Yeah, and so it also has many notable architectural features, such as these really high ceilings and large windows throughout, plus dark wood lockers rather than the metal. Clankety lockers of that you traditionally see in schools.
But can you really call them lockers? Maybe we should call them boxes in the wall or
cubbies
or cubbyholes.
Cubbies. So the opening is being downplayed by New York Mayor Mamdani and other New York politicos, presumably because they're just ideologically against the charter school concept. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because teacher unions are always against the charter school concept. So this Wall Street Journal op-ed frames the school as a rebuke to educational defeatism, citing a report that over 900 New York City schools have failure rates above 50% in reading and math. So 50% or more of their kids are not learning anything.
That's horrific.
Yeah. So
is funding, that on national standards or state standards?
No, that was New York City.
Yeah, I know it's New York City. But
on standards for, I guess, the state standards. I don't know. But the funding for this school came from a $100 million gift from former Mayor Michael Bloomberg, with the rest from a bond issue. Mm-hmm. So, in thinking about this, I was thinking about Catholic social teaching would absolutely be in favor of what they're doing, which is that the poor deserve, just like the rich or the middle class, this architecturally elegant building for your kids to go to school. And, you know, this this shouldn't just be confined to the kids in Westchester County in New York. Right. So any thoughts about that?
Well, my first thought is with $240 million, do you know how many schools I could make?
I know.
I used to be in charge of our schools for the Legion and Regnum Christi in the U.S., Canada, and Asia. And for $240 million, I could make about 100 schools.
Yeah. It is an astronomical number.
Oh,
and
gosh.
I think that's something – I want to say like the Braves Stadium – that they built in Cobb County was mm-hmm. something to like around $250 million to build just the stadium. So like you think about this
insane
school.
Insane amount of money that's going into that.
Right. And I'm sure it was because of all the regulatory red tape
yeah,
and you know, whatnot
of New York City. Yeah.
Right.
Undoubtedly so. But my thought turns to Catholic education. Like if we had those type of funds for Catholic education, I mean, I know a lot of people who are involved in charter schools and from a faith-based perspective. They're trying to bring charter schools to bear. I've worked with Chesterton and schools. I've worked with Regina Chaley and a number mm-hmm. of other small startups. And interesting thing about Catholic schools is they've always been there for that mission of educating everyone, not just the elite,
right.
but also the poor.
Right.
And the Catholic Church has done it more effectively and more a much lower rate than the public school system. So I wonder if that type of money had been dedicated by Mayor Bloomberg and this other source of funding was.
Yeah, it was a bond issue for the city bond issue.
Catholic schools that are already diffused around the city of
not
New York.
Not a chance.
Gosh.
Instead, they want the Catholic schools to close so that more kids go into the public school system. So the teachers' unions are
it's kind of a bizarre situation.
Enriched,
and it's a unique thing that we have here in the United States. In many other countries around the world, they recognize the value of Catholic schools, and the state will actually sanction and support financially.
Yeah.
Catholic schools.
Yeah.
But here in the United States, for whatever reason, there's this anti-Catholic prejudice, and we have this bizarre system where Catholic parents have to pay their taxes, their education taxes, school taxes, and then on top of that—
Right, so you double pay.
You double pay.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
According to a story in the Wall Street Journal, there are three chatbot behaviors that drive people interacting with them into delusional thinking. So sycophancy, which is the, you know, using flattery to gain advantage, linguistic alignment, and hyper-personalization. So AI models adapt significantly to the conversation style of the humans that use them. And I guess mm-hmm. this is a known way for humans to build rapport, right? Using the person you're talking to's syntax and mm-hmm. mannerisms and whatnot that builds
mimic
rapport.
Them.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I get I've
typical human behavior.
Yeah, I do that, right. Mm-hmm. So chatbots rephrase and extrapolate what you share with them, and they'll tell you your thoughts are unique and have great
implications. How do you know that what we're recording right now is not a chatbot?
Well,
I mean, maybe Chris, we've done enough of these programs. We just put this into AI, and now it's AI imitating us.
Well, when I read this article that I read cracked me up because I read the comments. The first comment I read was a guy that said to the author of the piece, "Very insightful. I understand completely. You're a very strong author. It's no wonder people listen to you."
Chris, you have such insightful ideas
yes.
and topics. Oh, I love speaking with you.
Right. All right. So I just was thinking about this. They point out these three different tactics that the chatbots are using. And
right.
I was wondering, okay, is this just a replay of the ancient Greek story of self-love, of Narcissus, where, you know, the god Nemesis observes his arrogance and then, you know, led him to the pool of water and he falls in love with his reflection and he never stops looking at himself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that kind of really what's just going on? It's just like it's just nothing new under the sun.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, that's the reality. It's playing off of our human tendencies.
Yeah.
And when we love to hear that we're great and we love to hear encouragement. And so that's how they've programmed these AI chatbots.
Yeah.
But they could be programmed in a different way.
Well, that's what somebody is suggesting. So there's a wrongful death suit after a teenager's suicide that they're suing Google, but Google ended up settling out of court. A Tennessee law professor argues that the real sort of check on AI won't come from regulators, but from a what they like to see as what bankers or financial advisors, doctors, and lawyers, a common law fiduciary duty mm-hmm. that the chatbots would have with you. So, so if the AI is functionally occupying a trusted advisor role without legal obligations that don't that normally come with them, right. then you're going to have problems. And so mm-hmm. I guess that makes a little bit of sense.
Yeah. I mean, for good or for ill, that's much of how our society has functioned. When lawsuits come along, it shifts the way that,
right.
Things are regulated and people self-regulate to avoid the lawsuits.
Right. Let's go back to talking about one of our frequent topics, legalized weed.
You bring this up a lot. I think you have a fixation with this.
Well, I do because every time I go to a park, I smell weed.
Yeah, it's true.
And
it's unfortunate.
It just blows my mind that people are – I think I've said this
to
you
before. What parks are you going to anyway?
Hammond Park. I play pickleball at Hammond Park,
and there's basketball
courts next to it. Yep. And everybody's smoking weed while playing basketball. I just don't get how you can do that.
But, I don't know. Maybe it relaxes their shot or something.
Yeah. So anyway. A Wall Street Journal interview by editorial board member Alicia Finley with Kevin Sabat, a longtime anti-marijuana activist, where they in this interview they explore whether America's marijuana legalization wave has crested. The data says about a third of Americans in their 20s used marijuana in the past month, and that daily marijuana use now outpaces daily alcohol use. I think we've
cited
that.
That's
before.
Incredible, and that's mind-blowing for me.
Right. So Sabat argues that legalization was sold on the promise that bringing pot into the legal realm would result in better regulation and disruption of the black market for the drug. Mm-hmm. It would also be a significant tax base, and that government labeling would make it safer.
Mm-hmm.
He says none of that has materialized. He notes that even the New York Times editorial board, which was pro-legalization in 2014, they had a official editorial piece backing it. They published a piece this past February acknowledging that legalization has produced worse outcomes than many Americans expected. And apparently at least one state, Massachusetts, has a repeal referendum on its November ballot this year to reverse course on legalized pot.
Mm.
I get this. I just don't. I mean, I hope that happens in Massachusetts, but I just don't think that we're going to ever unring this bell. I don't see any way. I don't think there's enough movement afoot.
I think it will come.
Policymakers.
Oftentimes, it comes through a groundswell of people's experience on the ground of realizing the negative effects of the pot smoking in their own life, the life of friends, how it's been a pathway to other drugs.
And so that's what happened with smoking tobacco.
Yes.
Okay, but there seems to be. I don't think there was ever an ideological bent to
tobacco.
It was just a habit that people knew was bad for you,
mm-hmm.
but you did it because it was so habit-forming.
But the tobacco companies, they didn't portray that it was bad for you. They always portrayed it as something really glorious and manly and everything. And so there mm-hmm. was a current of manipulation that was going on
back then. Sure.
So,
but you know what I mean? Now there seems to be a different angle on legalized weed of it being, particularly on the left, that it's part of the Democratic platform,
mm-hmm.
where I don't think that was ever the case with tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just don't see us unringing this bell. I mean, unless there's this, like you said, groundswell where it's centered around the actual damage from the smoke, mm-hmm. like there was with tobacco. There wasn't a groundswell of what the effects of nicotine were on your body. It was the smoke, the damage from the smoke.
No, but there's also, there were lawsuits. I'm sorry, we talked a lot about that last episode. I mean, lawsuits oftentimes would shift the nature of things, and they had to start putting warning labels on. So I think some of that could come
about. But, people chew the nicotine pouches are, more popular than ever. So the mm-hmm. actual
and
nicotine
vaping.
Is not the problem. It's the smoke. So I'm wondering if the only way that this reverses is the focusing on the smoke, not what the effects of THC that's the only way I see this thing going the other way.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. I think nicotine also has its negative effects. So it's not just the smoke. I mean, smoke clearly has, causing lung cancer and other things like that. But the nicotine is addictive,
mm-hmm.
and it causes problems like headaches and things. It's more addictive than caffeine.
Right.
So people are realizing the negative effects. There's some positive effects, but a lot of negative effects of caffeine too.
Yeah.
So I think as people become more aware of the issues that are tied to it, there could be a
let's see what happens in November in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
The Wall Street Journal did an editorial entitled "How Green Policies Fuel Fires in Europe," and you're aware that they've had
lots of wildfires, forest fires, and all throughout Europe. Yeah.
Right. So it argues that European fires in France and Spain are policy failure caused by the EU's conservation regulations. Under the EU Green Deal, which was approved in the year 2020, in order to meet a 55% emissions reduction target, 30% of the European continent was designated as nature protected.
Mm-hmm.
So one-third of that 30% is under strict protection, meaning it's to be left completely undisturbed. That means that standing trees and even deadwood retention are prioritized for carbon storage over fire resilience.
Mm-hmm.
So traditional land management by small farmers, which has historically been a natural check on fuel buildup, has also been undermined by the EU bureaucracy, which has squeezed out almost all of the small farms in Europe. And so that's also resulted in a population flight from rural to urban areas. And so if people aren't there, fires, you know, can get started and not be taken care of more quickly. So this Spanish forestry professor says the policy is rooted in ecological ideology rather than from applied forestry and fire science. He says it's a Bambi view that treats human presence in nature as inherently harmful. A study he co-authored found that in southwestern Europe's temperate forests, protected areas make up 38% of the forest land, but they account for 55% of the land that's been recently burned. Mm. So it's disproportionately more. The same research found that fires burn more intensely on protected lands in the country of Australia and in the state of California, who have similar policies.
Right.
But of course, instead of addressing the policy failure, the wonks are, and of course the media on board are blaming what? Climate change.
Oh, climate change. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think even the very environmentally friendly late Pope Francis would have said that this romanticized view of nature untouched by humans is not the correct answer. He explicitly affirmed the stewardship relationship, you know, with man
right.
and the land. So what are your thoughts about any of that?
I think that I am always a proponent of looking at the facts. There's always a danger of ideology blinding us to the facts that are right there before us. And certainly that can happen on either side of the political divide. And I think if people are honest and they're really willing to look at the facts, then we shift and update and upgrade policy so that it takes better care of places. And I think that's happened to a certain extent here in the United States. There are many states which have realized, hey, we need to do controlled burns or we need to do other things in order to truly care for the environment around us. I have a good friend who actually works with fire brigades in Florida, and he's created this device where he goes up and monitors forest fires. He was just telling me about he got called out to a group of 100 people to go out to Oregon and help with the
right.
forest fires out there.
Right.
And so forest fires are going to happen. And I was just talking with my mom last night.
Forest fires are good for the forest.
They can be. In fact, they regenerate. I was in a place in Grand Teton recently where they had a forest fire 10 years ago, and now it's all regrown with
right.
fresh growth. And the only way that certain pine trees can regenerate is when there's a fire.
Right.
So fire is not bad in and of itself. And so I think coming up with better policies by looking at the data is where we need to go.
Yeah, I just think this is another example of you come up with a policy that like has a good and you know genuine and good defensible goal, but then it doesn't work, and then you blame something else. It's like rent control in New York or San Francisco.
Yeah, I think ideologues will always do that, but honest people and real scientists will look at the data and say, hey, we need to update this policy.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed
Wires. A Wall Street Journal opinion piece co-authored by the Archbishop of San Francisco and the Bishop of Oakland tells the tale of California's Attorney General prosecuting two pro-life nonprofits in an ongoing trial in Oakland, seeking up to $20 million in fines from these organizations.
Hmm.
The state is suing these nonprofits for telling women who regret taking chemical abortion pills that a medical treatment exists, which can sometimes reverse the chemical abortion. They're suing them for telling them this.
For telling them the truth and giving them scientific data.
So the California Attorney General reportedly found no evidence that any woman has complained of harm from the nonprofit's advice. And the central case was a young woman who, at a Planned Parenthood clinic in 2023, expressed hesitancy to go through with her abortion and wanted to talk through her options. But mm-hmm. the staff there pressured her to take the abortion pill mm-hmm. immediately, and so she did. So she took the first pill. Then her boyfriend texted her saying that he wanted to keep the baby, prompting this frantic search that led her to Heartbeat International. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with them?
Yep.
Which connected her within an hour to a licensed California doctor for abortion pill reversal treatment. Mm-hmm. She testified before that she had been this huge supporter and donor to Planned Parenthood at the time. And now, guess what? She has a healthy baby daughter.
Wow. Awesome. Thanks be to God.
Right. So the main defense is that the nonprofits are saying is that, you know, informing a woman that an option exists but not administering the treatment itself is basically commercial speech. So if you would make this illegal, that makes everything in America mm-hmm. that's commercial speech illegal. So, you know, it's just another relentless attack on Catholic groups by particularly New York and California.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it made me think of that story of the nuns in Hawthorne, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Remember we talked about that?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're suing them to make sure that they use, that they don't have sex segregated bathrooms, to make sure they use preferred pronouns. These are for cancer patients in Hawthorne, New York,
oh my gosh.
No one's ever asked them to do this for them, but they're making them, you know, do this anyways.
That's a way of enforcing ideology.
Well, and that's the irony here. So, you know who founded this cancer home in New York?
No.
The daughter of Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Mm-hmm.
She became a nun.
Right.
And founded this cancer. What was this Nathaniel Hawthorne known for? The Scarlet Letter. What's the Scarlet Letter about?
Right.
Coercion through, you know, coercion tactics by the state.
Right.
And they're doing the exact thing. It's so ironic.
It really is. It's so interesting. And you bring up these two cases in Oakland and San Francisco. I was talking recently with a gentleman who helps out pro-life pregnancy aid centers all across the country. And he said that there's only one in all of San Francisco. One pregnancy aid clinic.
Right.
In the entire city of San Francisco,
right.
which has been persecuted by the city and the state government for decades to try to eradicate them and get them to close their doors. He said it's a very intentional.
Well, I mean, this case here, like, it was for them informing that it's possible. And in fact, it is possible because she did it and they have
a
healthy baby.
Girl, yeah.
And they're suing for something, for saying that something is possible.
All right. Yeah. It, to me, again, it goes back to the point we've been talking about in the last couple of episodes about looking at the facts. Why are people afraid of the facts? Look at the science. I mean, are we afraid of the truth? And that seems to be what's the driving element here. They're afraid for people to know the truth.
Well, and what they're not afraid of is anti-Catholic bigotry.
Yeah. Well, don't forget, the truth will set us free.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.